Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Grant Podolko, an editor at RFERL.org, and I'll be your host. On this week's show, correspondent Heather Marr introduces us to soldiers from the so-called 9/11 generation, who are finding life outside of the U.S. military as challenging as fighting insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan.
After a while, I wasn't taking my medication for my physical pain. I realized I was taking my medication for the emotional anguish that I was dealing with.
In our monthly Ear to the Ground segment, acclaimed Swiss composer and jazz pianist Nick Bertsch talks about his early influences, which may surprise you.
As a child, I was once in Romania when I was 8 years old, and I remember this trip because we listened to a lot of music and met a lot of people and heard a lot of live music, and I brought many records from this time.
And we learn more about the rather unorthodox way marijuana is harvested in one remote valley in Central Asia.
Just imagine people wash themselves in Chu River, the river which is there in the Chu Valley, and their horses are also washed there. And then for hours, they just ride their horse in huge, literally, forests of marijuana.
But first to Azerbaijan. The inability of journalists to work safely and freely is one of the biggest human rights issues in Radio Free Europe's broadcast countries. Nowhere is that more true than Azerbaijan, where reporters are routinely beaten, jailed, and even murdered for work seen as criticizing the regime of President Ilham Aliyev. One of the country's best-known journalists is Einula Fatulayev, who served 4 years in prison under grueling conditions for his reporting. Fatulayev was released in May. In recent weeks, he's been focused more on personal matters. He got married in late September. But he has never stopped working and says Azerbaijan needs critical voices now more than ever. RFE correspondent Daisy Sindelar sat down with Fatulayev and his wife Nigar during the couple's honeymoon visit to Prague.
Einula Fatulayev ran two of the most widely circulated opposition newspapers in Azerbaijan. During that time, he endured a brutal beating, the murder of a colleague, and the kidnapping of his own father, all punishment for his critical reporting on the country's president, Ilham Aliyev, and Baku's political elite. Then he was sent to prison, and things got even worse. Fatulayev, now 35, endured physical threats, rats, and failing health as he was moved from jail to jail under increasingly grim conditions. He says the low point came one winter, when he was placed in a Soviet-era holding cell with icy concrete walls and no way to stay warm.
The only way to survive was to remain constantly in motion. If I stood still for even a moment, I would have died. I didn't sleep for 15 days, and I was constantly moving around. The windows were open to the outdoors, and there was no bed. There was one very, very small heater, but then they turned that off as well. There were moments when I didn't know what to do, how to go on living, but I trained myself. I forced myself to continue my work, to continue the fight, and in the end, that fight gave me strength. It's a very complicated philosophy, something you can only experience in prison. When you're in a constantly mobilized situation, you don't have the right to relax. You even sleep with one eye open, because someone might try to kill you. It was a terrifying kind of lesson in survival.
And survive he did. After 4 years in prison, Fatulayev was released in May as part of a presidential amnesty. His release came an entire year after the European Court of Human Rights had ordered the Azerbaijani government to free the journalist, whose case had won broad support from groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. The Council of Europe's head of human rights, Thomas Hammerberg, personally intervened to allow newspapers to be delivered to the reporter. Fatulayev says that international attention proved the key to his survival. That and the dozens of books, from Ernest Hemingway to Russian poet Sergei Yesenin, that he read for comfort and inspiration. Without books, he said, he would have been broken.
Solzhenitsyn really helped me. I said to myself, look, people survived life in Stalinist prison camps. They didn't break. They survived. They even continued to fight. Solzhenitsyn, of course, wrote beautifully about all that. in the Gulag Archipelago, the First Circle, and other works. So I said to myself, you've got Hamburg coming to see you. Ambassadors are able to visit you. You can even send out newspaper articles talking about what you've gone through. But people 70 years ago didn't have any of those things. And they didn't break. They continued to fight. They continued the battle. So are you really such a weakling that you can't survive this?
Fatulayev, who is currently writing about his prison experiences in a blog for RFE's Azerbaijani service, is eager to return to newspaper publishing and says he has received hundreds of calls and letters from ordinary Azeris asking him to get back to work. Some of his friends have urged him to leave the country, but he says he won't give his former captors the satisfaction. I want them to know I'm still here, he says, alive, working, and telling the truth. He acknowledges that telling the truth might once again land him in trouble. Fatulayev, who is newly married, watched with distress as the marriage of his friend and fellow jail journalist Emin Mili fell apart under the pressure of his own struggle with the law. But Fatulayev's wife, Nigar, a surgeon, expresses no doubt about her choice, even though many members of her family begged her to reconsider.
Perhaps he'll be in prison again. Perhaps more of these unbelievable things will happen to him. We had a very important discussion before our marriage, and I told him, I'm ready to be with you until the end. I know what I'm getting into. And I will always support him, because every man should know that he's got someone behind him and that he can count on that. We have a very strong family, and even if it is officially only 3 days old at this point, I think it will continue for 30 or 40 more years, as much as fate allows.
Fatulayev teases his wife for her optimism, but he too is an optimist of sorts. In the long term, he believes, the domination of Azerbaijan's ruling elite over its citizens cannot last. In the short term, however, things appear to be going from bad to worse, and no Arab-style scenario, he says, is likely to change that.
Unfortunately, we're witnessing a transformation in our country from authoritarianism to totalitarianism. And the first signs of a totalitarian system are limits on the right to expression and freedom of speech. Our imitation democracy is over. Any early signs of liberalism were nipped in the bud. So it's very difficult to live in this country, let alone to resume journalistic work. As soon as I was released, I immediately said that I had been arrested and jailed in one country and freed in a completely different one.
That was journalist Einula Fatulayev talking about the high price of criticizing the government in Azerbaijan. Fatulayev will travel to New York in November to belatedly pick up the International Press Freedom Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists, which he received in 2009 while he was serving his 4-year prison sentence. And while we're on the subject of press freedom, I would be remiss if I didn't mention the case of Dovlet Yaskuliev, a reporter for RFERL's Turkmenistan service, who this week was sentenced to 5 years in jail after being convicted on charges of encouraging a relative's suicide attempt. I'm joined by Jamal Yazlieva, the director of our Turkmen service. Jamal, tell us more about his case, please.
Dovlet Murat Yaskuliev's trouble started when he was following the explosion in Abadan city last July. And at his reporting, he mentioned about some sensitive issues, critical issues towards the Turkmen government connected with the explosion.
And these were explosions in an arms depot,
yes,
I believe?
Yes. And he took pictures, he reported about the explosions. And after that, he was summoned by the secret police and seriously warned that he should stop reporting about the events in Turkmenistan. They blamed him in false information in his reports in connection with the explosion. Since that time, he has been under strict surveillance by the secret police, and the latest plot connected with his family members made his trouble even worse. Now he is sentenced to 5 years in jail, despite the fact that during the court hearing yesterday, family members and the person who was related to this family plot spoke in support of Daulat Murat Yazgulev. They said that they were under pressure of the secret police and they wrote a complaint against Daulat Murat. But later, their trial to get to withdraw their complaint ended with failing.
And so these charges, as far as you're concerned and his family are concerned, are just trumped up charges that have...
Yes.
They're only related to the fact that he reported on the this explosion.
It was just the reason for the local authorities to punish Daulat Murat Yazgulev for his critical journalism.
Can you talk a little bit, as the director of our Turkmen service, about the challenges that your staff members face in reporting from that very closed country?
It is very difficult to report from Turkmenistan. We have few correspondents, stringers, working for us. They are working under very difficult situations. They are constantly under pressure. They are constantly watched by the secret police. Time to time, they are summoned, questioned about their activities. They have limited access to the communication means, internet, telephone.
Well, our thoughts go out to Mr. Yazgulev and his family. Thank you, Jamal, very much for joining us on The Blender.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that The Blender is the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe. RFE brings radio, internet and television news to 21 countries across the former Soviet Union, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq and the Balkans. If you'd like to get in touch, it's very easy. Drop us a line at podcast@rferl.org or leave a comment on the Blender section of our website. And remember, you can download episodes of The Blender from our website or by subscribing on iTunes. A new episode is posted every Friday.
Some 2 million U.S. military members have been sent to fight or serve in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. Many were inspired to enlist after the terror attacks of September 11th, 10 years ago. But for an increasing number of them, joining the military has proven easier than leaving it. RFE correspondent Heather Marr reports.
President Barack Obama recently paid tribute to what he called the 9/11 generation of military members, men and women who have filled the ranks of the U.S. Armed Forces since 2001.
It's fitting that we salute the extraordinary decade of service rendered by the 9/11 generation, the more than 5 million Americans who've worn the uniform over the past 10 years. They were there on duty that September morning, having enlisted in a time of peace, but they instantly transitioned to a war footing. They're the millions of recruits who have stepped forward since, seeing their nation at war and saying, "Send me."
Wars have always filled hospital beds, but the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought advancements in battlefield medicine and body armor that have dramatically increased survival rates. More than 45,000 U.S. troops have been wounded in the last 10 years in both wars. Army First Lieutenant Cameron Kerr is one of them. He stepped on an improvised explosive device while helping to clear an area near a village in Afghanistan's Kandahar province. His left leg had to be amputated below the knee. At the military hospital outside of Washington, where he's recuperating, he said he sees plenty of fellow soldiers who have lost more than he did.
These guys then get injured, sometimes radically changing their life. Some guys become very depressed. There's people that lose everything up to the waist, including genitalia, which is a huge blow to a young man. Because if they don't have kids already, it just means they will never be able to have kids. And so those guys especially, you can tell those guys are just severely depressed, unfortunately, and that's where you see some suicides.
In July, the Army recorded its highest monthly toll of suicides ever, 32. And last year, suicide rates across all branches of the military rose 20% to 468. Experts attribute the increase to psychological problems caused by traumatic experiences and the stress of multiple deployments. Some 800,000 troops have been sent to war in Iraq and Afghanistan more than once, and it's thought nearly a quarter of veterans have some form of post-traumatic stress disorder or clinical depression.
Obviously, the injury itself, it's pretty traumatic in most cases. Getting blown up, I can tell you, is not a fun experience I would wish on anybody. Some guys were lucky and they blacked out, but a lot of us were conscious the whole time, which makes it even worse. And then most guys have been deployed several times now, have seen things that nobody else should have to see, especially at ages 19 or 20 or whatever they are.
Nancy Schirillo was a U.S. Marine serving in Al Asad, Iraq, in February of 2005, when a mortar round exploded a large fuel tank she was standing near. She lost her right eye. Back home, she found herself sinking into a well of depression.
I'm a 25-year-old female, and I have to wear a patch on my eye, and I have no eyeball in my head. I didn't leave my house. I was on heavy medication for the pain and for depression, and I was starting to feel myself abuse it more and more. Because after a while, I wasn't taking my medication for my physical pain. I realized I was taking my medication for the emotional anguish that I was dealing with. I didn't want to think. I didn't want to feel.
Dr. Sherry Balter is an expert in post-combat adjustment and has spent the last decade working for a veterans assistance group in Florida called Faith, Hope, Love, Charity, Incorporated.
A number of our veterans experience significant losses. It might be death of fellow soldiers, friends, be it loss of limbs or some of their physical functioning, relationships, even dealing with the loss of close attachments that they made while on the battlefield. A number of our veterans are dealing with addiction and substance abuse.
The National Coalition for Homeless Veterans estimates that 20% of America's homeless are military veterans. Phil Landis is the head of Veterans Village of San Diego, which helps more than 2,000 homeless vets each year. Most of the mostly men who come to Veterans Village have addiction or mental health issues.
When you are involved in combat and then you leave the military, the world isn't always as understanding as you would like it to be. Society doesn't always take into consideration those bits and pieces that you bring back with you from combat that may shade your own sense of awareness. Certainly doesn't help with patience.
The statistics are disheartening, but there is growing consensus that the military is much better now than it once was at treating the invisible wounds of war. The Department of Veterans Affairs has expanded its mental health services and set up crisis hotlines, and it says it will increase its staff of substance abuse counselors by 30%. They will be needed. As the United States winds down its military commitment in Iraq and Afghanistan, the number of soldiers returning home is only going to grow.
That was RFE correspondent Heather Marr reporting from Washington.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Саатки хабарларда.
Затун GTM.
Аз аскултат.
Совместная программа Центральноазиатских
служб.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Moldova's Ethno Jazz Festival just celebrated its 10th anniversary with another year of successful concerts at the National Theater in the capital, Chișinău. In our monthly Ear to the Ground segment, Romanian music journalist Lucian Stefanescu introduces us to the music of the group known as Mozulu Art, as well as Swiss composer and pianist Nick Birch.
If you ever wondered what Austria and Zimbabwe might have in common, you will find at least one answer listening to this. It is Mozart, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, played by Mozulu Art, one of the bands in the lineup of the 10th edition of the Ethno Jazz Festival in Chișinău, capital of Moldova. The festival is organized since 2001 by Alexandru Ștefăneț, the leader of the Moldovan jazz band Trigon, and Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty was one of the media partners at 2011 edition. So, how was the mood at the National Theatre in Chișinău between 22 and 25 of September? And what bands did he like the most? I put these questions to one of RFERL's correspondents in the Moldovan capital, Paul Hodorogea.
It was special. I never knew that so many people in Moldova like jazz. This year I saw a lot of audience standing because they did not find a seat. Mozul Art was the band that I liked the most. The audience enjoyed different kind of music, music from Italy, Poland, United States, Sweden. I was also impressed by the show of Nick Ronin from Switzerland because he was playing the piano and he was looking at his fingers floating over the keys like he was wondering himself, whoa, look what these fingers can do.
RFRL's correspondent in Chisinau, Paul Hodoroja. We will come back to Nick Berch later in this program, but let's listen first to a fragment of the interview Paul did with Dumanisani Ramadu Moyo from Mozulu Art.
Zulu music, a type of vocalism without instruments, sang by special men, and this is, we call it Istatamia or Imbube. This is the kind of music with the Mozart influence and the original Mozart compositions, where we are singing on top of what Mozart composed, and then we are putting the text and the Zulu feeling of it. We have lived in Vienna, in Austria, where Mozart, the country where he was born. We have lived there and we studied there, the three of us. And so we thought of doing something together which identifies with the Austrian culture. We came as a group from Zimbabwe and we were singing a cappella, and we are still singing a cappella, but with more Zulu art. It's a fusion of Imbube music, a cappella music, and Mozart influence.
Listening to Pakati, a song by Mozulu Art. The Swiss composer and pianist Nick Berch played with his band Ronin several times at the Ethno Jazz Festival in Chisinau, and he says his music is influenced by Romanian and Moldovan traditional music. RFRL's bureau chief Vasile Bodnaru spoke to Nick Berch.
Did you bring from Moldova something new, some sound, some color in your composition?
We have been often in Romania and Moldova now, and as a child I was once in Romania when I was 8 years old, and I remember this trip because we listened to a lot of music and met a lot of people and heard a lot of live music, and I brought many records from this time. So I'm kind of inspired already as a child from Romanian rhythm and folk songs, and as we know, Moldavian and Romanian tradition have a lot in common, so that's probably also why many people hear this in our music.
In Moldova, people argue, what is it authentic music? How is it folk authentic? It's possible to mix jazz with folk.
Authentic is a difficult term because sometimes folk music is also not authentic because it's made out of a tradition, not created by the people but by a kind of a nationalistic thinking. So I think authentic means if a musician really dedicates his life to a music and develops something in his own style. That's authentic. It's the person that makes a music music authentic. I write music and I'm inspired by many things, classical music like Stravinsky, folk music, but also funk and jazz. But it's primarily a music of our community. So we played since years together and developed the music constantly. So it's the continent of community.
Module 47 by Nick Birch and Ronin. My name is Lucian Ștefănescu. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned to The Blender.
And now for something completely different. I'm here in the studio with my Radio Free Europe colleague, Merhat Cherepjanov. Frequent listeners to The Blender will remember Merhat from our regular Uncovered segments, but I've invited him onto the show this week to talk about marijuana. A month or so ago, Merhat wrote a provocative blog post for our English language website that ended up receiving a lot of international attention. Merhat was a guest on Public Radio International's The World news magazine, and in the United States, his story was used on a segment of National Public Radio's very popular quiz show called Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Let's hear a bit from that show from Wait, Wait.
Next time you're really high and wondering how they get the cream filling into a Hostess cupcake or how much wood a woodchuck could actually chuck, don't contemplate where that weed you just smoked comes from. You might not want to know the answer. Residents of the Chew Valley, a remote region between Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, have a rather unorthodox method for harvesting their hash.
So, not to be outdone, I've invited Merhat onto The Blender to talk about his story. Welcome back to The Blender, Merhat.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here today.
So tell us, what exactly is this unorthodox method for harvesting hashish?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to see it myself many years ago when I was doing some reports about this back in late 80s. The local people in Chew Valley in South Kazakhstan, the Chew Valley, we have to mention here, is a huge valley which divides Kazakhstan from neighboring Kyrgyzstan, and there are hundreds of kilometers, about 250 kilometers long valley with a so-called dichka. It's the name of wild marijuana.
Wild marijuana.
Yeah, it's wild marijuana. And Soviet Union officials were doing everything to eliminate that wild plantations. It didn't work. They used pesticides, they were burning everything out, but it would never was extinguished and yeah. Extinct. And after that, there was even legends around the Soviet Union. All those who loved to use marijuana, of course illegally, they preferred to have it from Chew Valley, and it became a legend there. So I went there to make a report on it. What I saw appalled me, even though I am from Central Asia myself. I'm not originally from that area. I'm from the northeast. And there I saw that people wash themselves in Chew River, the river which is there in the Chew Valley, and their horses are also washed there. And then for hours they just ride their horse in huge, literally, forests of marijuana. And when the resin of marijuana and their sweat mix, and the sweat of humans who are naked on the horses, and the horses' sweat mix, they just scratch out the mixture and make what they call plastiline or plasticine, which is very, used to be, I don't know about now, but used to be very highly appreciated by drug users in the former Soviet Union.
So naked people wash themselves, they get on a clean horse, ride through a field of marijuana, and the rosin from the marijuana basically sticks to their sweaty bodies.
That's right.
And they scrape it off and dry it or put it into some
sometimes,
sort of like...
Sometimes they even don't dry it. They just put some piece of it in the normal cigarette and get high. But very often they just press it, dry it, and it's very concentrated. And I was told that this is very easy to stash it because only just one or two... Small pieces of it are enough to make people happy.
Well, as you probably know, you wrote about this about a month ago on our English language website, and then it was picked up by other agencies. And a lot of the people who've left comments have said this is ridiculous. This is just an urban legend that the hashish, the plasticine, would be harvested this way. But you said you saw this with your own eyes.
Well, I agree with those people. Well, for many years, I'm living in the western part of the world. I know that some people who grew marijuana in their labs or small places like illegal plantations, any piece of it is precious, and they just do some, preciously gather all stuff from their bushes and, stuff like that. But first of all, and during the Soviet time and even now in Central Asia, there are no labs. They have all this for free. It's a huge, big valley. People don't have any idea how to process these things in labs or something like that. It's the easiest way for them just to ride a horse in a naked way and get it. And the other thing is one of the major... issues here is anytime if police stops them, they're just riding horses. That's
they've got a good alibi.
right. Well, so that's also the one of the, of course, the police there is very corrupt, and very often they just are bribed and close eyes, and in many cases they are themselves involved in this because many people don't necessarily ride the horses. They just ran themselves in a naked way there. So
well, it certainly does seem like a very inefficient but, I guess, fun way of harvesting what is, of course, illegal substance. Thank you, Merhat, very much for joining us and telling us more about this very interesting story.
Thank you very much for having me here today.
And that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks so much for turning on the blender. Until next week, this is Grant Padalko. Take care, everybody. Starting